The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of wisdom.
Continuing on our series of topics about qualities of leadership in Scripture, and today I want to discuss one of the most important ones, one that we don't pick up at university, though we really well should consider that, and that's wisdom. The issue of wisdom is relating to the whole concept of the skill and the art of living life. It has to do with skill. Doesn't have to do with so much with knowledge as it does with the application of knowledge in very specific ways to various arenas of our lives. And the Proverbs, of course, are filled with profound wisdom because, as you might think of a proverb as a short sentence based on long experience. And that's exactly what it is. It's a tremendous amount of experience. And we go back here 3,000 years, and we're dipping deeply into the well of wisdom. And frankly, this was something that was treasured in ancient Israel, ancient Egypt, and so forth. There were sages and people who were capable of communicating wise perspectives on a wide variety of issues who were sought out. And Solomon, as you well know, was one such person who was sought out from countries all over that whole area. And people would seek him out for wise counsel and for wisdom. Underlying that concept, then, it would be the understanding that there are so many mistakes we can make in life. Be prudent for us to gain experience from the mistakes of others as well. It's been said that a wise man learns from the mistakes of others. No one lives long enough to make them all himself. So there's a lot of truth to that. So in picking this up, I want us to look, first of all, at Proverbs chapter 8, which is wisdom's invitation to receive understanding, knowledge, discernment, prudence, every right path. So wisdom in Proverbs 8 is personified as a woman who communicates and invites the seeker to gain skill. Because in the Hebrew language, the word chokhmah is a word which can be translated skill. And that's really what the word wisdom refers to. It's a word that was used of the men who were instrumental in fabricating the tabernacle. These are not the best known men in the Scriptures. There were two men that said that God put a spirit of wisdom upon them, which means skill. And they could take raw material and they could craft it and shape it into something that was beautiful and functional. Very rarely will people get that down, but Bezalel and Aholiab were the two men who were said to have had a spirit of wisdom, which meant that they had skill. They had the ability to take raw material and to shape it and craft it. Now, there's an obvious parallel. In the book of Proverbs, you and I are viewed in our youth as that raw material. We are unshaped. We are precious. We have an intrinsic worth, but we are unshaped and undisciplined, and we are naive. We are subject to waywardness and every false direction. And thus, in wisdom, the wisdom literature, the idea is that we would receive instruction and discipline so that we could be shaped and corrected and prepared in advance for a way of living in such a way that there is something beautiful that's created out of that raw material. That's the idea, that we all need discipline. And discipline is necessary to the attainment of a skill. You well know that any skill you have today is a result of discipline. That you were willing to discipline yourself and take the long-term perspective, and that whatever skill it is, whether it's in sports or in any aspect of your life, any skill in business, any skill at all in life that's worth attaining will require the willingness to discipline yourself in order to attain that skill and to be able to understand the way life is. And so I would invite us to look at this. I heard a silly story about a faculty meeting, and the dean was visited by this angel who said, because of your superlative life, I'm going to give you a choice between unbounded wisdom, wealth, or beauty. And he, of course, chooses wisdom without any hesitation. And then when the angel leaves in a poof, he kind of sits there with a kind of a faint glow around him. And the other faculty members in a hushed silence say, "Say something to us." And his first remarks were, I should have taken the money. kind of a scary thought. Wisdom, I should have taken the money. Actually, as we'll see here, wealth is nothing compared to wisdom. In Proverbs 8, then, verses 1 to 36, I won't read the whole text, but I'm going to focus particularly on 12 and following. I, wisdom, to dwell together with prudence. Again, it's a skill. Wisdom is being presented in a personified way. The fear the Lord is to hate evil. I hate pride and arrogance, evil behavior and perverse speech. Counsel and sound judgment are mine. I have understanding and power. By me kings reign and rulers make laws that are just. By me princes govern and all nobles who rule on earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me. With me are riches and honor, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is better than fine gold. What I yield surpasses choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, along the paths of justice, bestowing wealth on those who love me and making their treasuries full. And it's more than just a physical wealth. It has to do with really wealth in life and the things that really count in the end. The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. It's another image here of the skill that God used in creating and crafting the created order. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. And so it describes this. And then at the end of the chapter, she says, "Now then, my sons, listen to me," verse 32. "Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not ignore it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway." There's this image of a receptive heart that quests for wisdom. "For whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from the Lord. But whoever fails to find me harms himself. All who hate me love death." Malcolm Muggeridge once said that every happening, great and small, is a parable whereby God speaks to us, and the art of life is to get the message. It's an important idea. Every event in our lives, every happening, great and small, is a parable whereby God speaks to us. And I think that's true, that events in our lives are not neutral. We learn from them, from positive and negative experiences. The art of life is to get the message so that we go through the process of gaining wisdom through our experience, but also gaining wisdom through the experience of others, so that we're capable and willing to receive by pursuing people who are further down the road than we are and who can be mentors for us and to give us insight. And the scriptures provide a form of mentoring in our lives, a form of instruction, so that the result will be that we learn and live and not just live and learn. It's both. Live and learn, but it's also good to learn and live. To seek the right kind of wisdom from the start rather than just making mistakes is the idea here. So living life in the superlative, a life of excellence, is what this is all about. So the concept here, then, is to pursue a life that's different and to heed wisdom's instruction. So I want to begin with wisdom and who God is. That some people in this world are crafty and some are shrewd. We know this. There are a lot of people who have worldly wisdom, but who do not have wisdom as the scriptures would say. We're not talking about craftiness and shrewdness. There are people who are gifted at conniving and getting away with things. That's not the same as this kind of wisdom. This is a wisdom that comes from God. And in Job chapter 28, we have a meditation here on the source of wisdom. The whole chapter really is a focal point of how precious this is, but where do we find this hidden path? How do we discover what it looks like? And so he begins in the meditation and talks about the searching, the sources, and bringing hidden things to light. But where can wisdom be found, verse 12? And where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says it's not in me. The sea says it's not with me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. And so he goes through this meditation here on where wisdom can't be found. The question is, it seems to be hidden from every living thing. Destruction and death say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it. He alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To shun evil is understanding. So the scriptures invite us to see that you will not find true skill in the art of living life apart from God, who is the source, the fountainhead of all wisdom. He is the one who is the wellspring from wisdom. He alone, then, is the one that we turn to. And the wisdom of God, look at the created order. Look at the beauty of the created order, the subtlety of the created order, the richness, the intricacy, the variety, and the splendor of all that we, if we were to look at any insect, any plant, any animal, anything in the created order, points beyond itself to an elegance and to a craftsmanship that's exquisite, in fact, beyond our skill. Any living thing that you can think of is far more rich and complex and wonderful than anything we've been able to create. Even a living cell would be true. There's no computer that we've ever been able to invent, nor I believe could invent, that is as complex and wonderful and intricate as even a living cell, let alone the whole plant or animal. The whole structure is exquisite. And we discover then the powers and perfections of God that are in the created order, the splendor of this order. And we understand then that the cultivation of the fear of God is the source of wisdom. It says in Proverbs 9:10, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Now, I would say that a paraphrase for that, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. A way of paraphrasing that might be this: a reverential awe before God and an acknowledgement of His ways is the foundation upon which the skill and the art of living life and all of its various components is really based. It's the foundation. The foundation for living life wisely is the fear of God. And the fear of God can be described in a variety of ways, but it's, in part it's to nurture an attitude of awe, of humility, of a sense of the terror of God, but also the concept in the fear of God of wishing to please Him and fearing to His displeasure. That is to say, there's a sense of accountability. There's a sense that this is serious, that life is serious, it counts. When a kid, for example, is doing poorly in high school, there might become a point where they realize, wait a minute now, this might count. If I want to go to college, I better get my act together. Or if you're in college and you're screwing up, as many of us did, there comes a point where you say, you better get your act together because now it starts to count. In other words, play is over, and now you're going to get a transcript. And when people get their heads together, often they realize, I better turn things around before it's too late. This is serious, it counts. In other words, it's to realize, if that's true there, how much more is this whole life, the one we only one we have on this planet, count? And we don't want to waste our years and making stupid decisions and then to regret them in the long run. So it's to really walk in this world with humility before God, having an attitude of awe and amazement, and also a desire to be pleasing to Him, and where you take God's pleasure and displeasure more seriously than in that of people. That's a very important concept, that you're more seriously concerned about God's pleasure and displeasure than you are about that of people's pleasure and displeasure. So it is to be under divine authority as one who will surely give an account. I believe then humility relates to the following concepts. Wisdom relates to trust. It relates to teachability, so that a person who trusts God, who is teachable, to servanthood and to responsiveness and reliance on God. Those things, I would say, trust, humility, teachability, servanthood, responsiveness and reliance on God. All those, I think, are facets of wisdom. And in other words, it's the exact opposite of autonomy and arrogance. The fool is the one who is autonomous, independent, and arrogant. He supposes he can order his steps. The wise person knows that our steps are not ordered by ourselves, but ultimately by God, and that He is the one who takes authority. So trust, humility, teachability, servanthood, responsiveness, and reliance on God are all facets of this wisdom. Psalm 86:11 says, "Teach me your way, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name." A very important word that. Give me an undivided heart, which means if your heart is divided, you cannot fear God. To have a single heart, an undivided heart, is to will one thing above all else. And if it is to will His will, now you have a focused heart and then a clear eye. And so in that regard, then, we develop an eternal perspective on our lives. One way of defining wisdom is it's the ability to use the best means at the best times to accomplish the best ends. It's the ability to use the best means at the best times to accomplish the best ends. And it's the skillful and practical application of truth to the ordinary aspects of life. I want you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 3, a wonderful story there. And let me ask you, as you're turning to that, this question. If someone were to appear to you who had great power and offered you one wish, what would your wish be? We hear about stories about a genie. Remember, the genie usually offers three wishes. Usually somebody fouls up with their wishes. They're not being specific enough, or it's just dumb requests, whatever. But suppose it wasn't a genie. Now instead, suppose it's the living God. Instead of three wishes, He issues you one choice. You get one wish only. Now, let me ask you this question. What would you ask for? Now, you might tell me what you might ask for and sound very pious, but you'd have to really work on this one. What would you really ask for if given that opportunity? It's a good question to ask because it'll tell you a lot about yourself, about your value system, about what you treasure. What would you honestly ask for if it was the one thing? Here we have a story where such a thing actually happened in history, where Solomon was approached by God in a dream, and God spoke to him and said, "Ask anything you want. It can be wealth, power, victory over your enemies. It can be long life. Anything you want, I'll give you one thing." You recall what he asked for. He asked for wisdom so that he can judge the people with prudence and discernment and understanding. And God is pleased with his answer. It's here in this text, in 1 Kings chapter 3. And when Solomon is offered this question, "Ask whatever you want for me to give to you," he says, "Now, Lord my God," verse 7, "you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I'm only a little child. I do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" And God's response, you know, the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for wisdom for this. So God said to him, "Since you have asked for this and not for a long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I'll give you a long life." And he woke and he realized it had been a dream. In my view, this text is illustrative of Matthew 6:33. "Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." It's the one thing most needful. So it's the old argument again, what we've talked about before, the principle of first and second things. Go for the first things first, and the second things are thrown in. Seek the second things first, and you'll not only miss out on the first, but also even on the benefits of the second things. Go for heaven, and you'll discover the true joys of earth can be thrown in. But if you go for earth first, in preference to heaven, you not only miss out on heaven, but you also miss out on the true joys of earth. So that the principle of first things, going for those, God takes care of the secondary things if you put the first things right in your heart. So wisdom then is the skill of living your life with each facet of life under His dominion. If Christ is at the center of your life, then the spokes find their orientation around the hub. But if He's not at the hub, then your life is going to be truly discombobulated. It's going to be a life that's not ordered and not really directed. But if Christ is at the center of your life, then the other things find their proper orientation and they are going to be oriented correctly. It's not to say that you're going to have a painless life, because pain, we know in Scripture, is part of the process of growth and of discernment and of insight. But it means, though, that you will go through a life that will increase in wisdom because you'll be responsive to what God has for you. There's a contrast between the two kinds of wisdom, the wisdom of this world and the wisdom of the Word. In James chapter 3, you don't need to turn to it, but it's in verses 14 to 17. If you harbor envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom, so-called, does not come down from heaven, but it's earthly and spiritual of the devil. Where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you have disorder and every evil practice. That's the wisdom of the world. And we see it all the time in our experiences. Read the newspapers, see how envy, selfish ambition, pride, and foolishness can destroy our lives. But the wisdom that comes from heaven, the wisdom from above, is totally different than the wisdom of this world. It is, first of all, pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy, good fruit, impartial, and sincere. So the wisdom of Christ is very different from the wisdom of this world. By the way, let me suggest thinking about the book of Proverbs as we've been saying, as we've been talking. But frankly, the book of Proverbs is so great that I would encourage you to consider reading a chapter a day for 31 days. 31 chapters, do it in a month, and give that some thought, and see. Look for a particular gem, a nugget, in that day's reading that would speak to you for that day, and seek to apply that text in your life for that very day. It would be a very informative way to go. Some people have done this for a long time, many times, and I will occasionally just do that and make that a daily reading, so the day of the month would be just pick up from that day of the month and just make that your day's reading. But particularly, look for something that God gives you that you can practice in your business and in your relationships and in your experience for that day. And I think that's reading the Scriptures with an open heart and receptiveness, which is one of the wisest things you and I can do, is to show up before God on a daily basis. To show up is the key part of it, and to show up with an open heart and an open Bible, and invite the with your open heart to be submissive to the Word and let that seep into you and receive it and then seek to apply it. To receive this and then with an attitude of applying it is the wisest thing we can do. In Proverbs chapter 1, going to the beginning of this wonderful book, where it gives us the theme of the book, again, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. We see this theme repeated in Scripture. The fear of the Lord is the beginning, or the source, or the fountain of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and discipline. And what we have in Proverbs 1 at the end of chapter 1 is wisdom who threatens to laugh at people's disaster when it's at first sounds, gosh, this doesn't sound very comforting, but actually it's a word that's saying, if you fail to hear my oracles, then it will haunt you, and you will miss out on what you sought to have. Harry Lehman told me about this court statement that I've always liked. The judge said, you shall not be allowed to swim hither and thither in a sea of uncertainty until harpooned by final judgment. I rather like that image. You shall not be allowed to swim hither and thither in a sea of uncertainty until harpooned by final judgment. That's exactly what this text is saying. You can only swim so long and be naive without any commitments. You need to ultimately have and make a commitment, make a decision, or you're going to be harpooned in the end. You need to make a decision, and you need to think about life in advance. I came across this poem, "When I have ceased to break my wings against the faultiness of things, and learn that compromises wait behind each hardly opened gate. When I can look life in the eyes, grown calm and very coldly wise, life will have given me the truth and taken in exchange my youth." There is this expression that we grow too soon old and too late smart. That idea here that youth is wasted on the young. Well, the fact is, it takes a certain amount of experience to gain perspective and discernment. But wisdom would invite us to take the long-range view and to learn things in advance. What we have here is, when it talks about this, Since you ignored all my advice and would not accept my rebuke, I in turn will laugh at your disaster. I will mock when calamity overtakes you. What you have here is a song of wisdom after the fact. And then how many of us have made stupid blunders and looked back to regret that and wished that we'd only heard or listened to the counsel we had received? When they call to me, but I will not answer. They will look for me, but they will not find me, since they hated knowledge and didn't choose to fear the Lord. Since they would not accept my advice, they spurned my rebuke. In other words, the idea is it's a matter of your choice, your will. What is it that you wish? But you must humble yourself in order to receive my words. The waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. Gary Richmond tells a story about a neighbor of hers. Her name was Julie, a neighbor who bought at a pet store a 90-day-old raccoon as a pet, a three-month-old raccoon. And came to love this thing. It would sit in her shoulders and often would kind of look her full in the face with a quizzical look and grab her cheeks, and she just would she found this to be a wonderful companion. She'd kiss him, hug him, and so forth. And the thing kept growing. When it reached another 18 months, now it was 18 more months went by, and it was 25 pounds. And the thing was a little bit less playful, but still would love to do that, and she enjoyed this. Gary happened to talk with the zoo veterinarian when at this point the raccoon was now pushing close to 30 pounds, and he asked the vet about these raccoons. He says, you know, my neighbor Julie seems to be having a wonderful time with this thing. Why don't more people have raccoons as pets? He says there's a reason. Something happens in their system, actually, that there is a chemical change that takes place when they're about 24 months old. And in this change, then, that, as he puts it, an unpredictable glandular change. And he says they become unpredictable, independent, and often attack their owners. He says, are there any exceptions? None that I know of, he said thoughtfully. Says, then Julie is likely to be bitten. He says, any time now, I should think. He said with great confidence. And so Gary actually went to Julie and said, you know, here's what the vet, who's really a world-class veterinarian, he's well-known, what he said at our zoo, what he said about your raccoon. And he warned her. And she said, you know, that's just not going to happen to me. She said, it's going to be different for me. My Bandit, that was the name, is different. And she smiled as she added, Bandit wouldn't hurt me. He just wouldn't. Three months later, Julie underwent plastic surgery for facial lacerations sustained when her adult raccoon attacked her for no apparent reason. Bandit was released into the wild. Now, it's an interesting thing. What was her mindset? It may happen to others, won't happen to me, is the mindset. We can hear good advice. We think, that's good advice for others. I don't need it. It's going to be different for me. It's not going to be different for you. And so often we learn too late when we look back and realize we heard good counsel and we spurned it. That's what wisdom is saying. You refuse to submit to my counsel. In your arrogance, you suppose somehow that you were a case of one, that you were different from others. Frankly, you failed to listen to the advice that you received. Many men I know fail to listen to the wisdom of their spouse to their detriment. And most men, when they fail to listen to their wife regarding financial and relational matters, make serious mistakes. There are exceptions, and sometimes the wife can be the one who makes the blunders in that area. I realize that. And there are times when each of us has wisdom in one area, and another will have another wisdom in another area. But we would do well to listen to wise counsel, and before making important decisions, seek out people who at least have some experience in this area to discern what choices we should be making. It's the long-range view. My father saved me a lot of grief about driving. My father was a bus driver. Never had an accident, and I don't know how many years. He drove for over 35 years, I believe. And one of the things he taught me, I still remember, was that you don't drive just according to the car in front of you, but you look ahead and see patterns up ahead of him. So you always look with a long view perspective. So that, because otherwise, this guy in front of you may be reacting too late, and then it's too late for you. served me well when I was going into the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. I may have told you this story, but it bears repeating. Going into that and into the tunnel, I looked, and way off in the distance, I saw, way in the dark, there were two lanes as I was heading from Manhattan to Brooklyn. And I saw red lights coming up, and they were starting to head my way, so I immediately started to hit my brakes, way, way before the people in front of me did that. But I hit my brakes as hard as I could without the guy behind me hitting me. So I tried to back off so that this guy wouldn't rear-end me. And sure enough, there was an accident, and it was coming our way, and the guy in front of me smashed into the car in front of him. I was able to avoid that because of the distance that I had. And frankly, what I did, I just turned around and drove out of the thing. I just made a U-turn and got the heck out of there. Now, my point here is, and frankly, the guy behind me, you know, he doesn't know me, but I saved him a little grief as well, and the guy behind him, and probably about 5-10 cars behind them, because you know how these things go backwards and just keep on multiplying. I thank my dad for that, in that, because it was an experience. But you know, there's an analogy in life. Look by looking ahead. Don't just look at the guy in front of you, but go and see patterns. Look for and discern, so you can anticipate the way things work in life. And that's part, I think, of taking the long-term perspective, so that you do not recognize wisdom after the fact. And the last verse I want to turn to is Proverbs 24:14. Proverbs 24:14, written to young men who are being educated for leadership, Solomon tells them that wisdom is essential to their future hope. And he says, "Know also that wisdom is sweet to your soul. If you find it, there is a future and hope for you, and your hope will not be cut off." He uses the analogy of honey from a honeycomb. Wisdom is also sweet, like honey to your soul. If you find it, there's a future and a hope, and your hope will not be cut off. The fact is that we well know that knowledge isn't all that it's cracked up to be. You can be familiar with the fact that there are two trees in the garden. What were the two trees? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then there was the other one. We got the wrong one. Yeah, we chose the wrong one. We chose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Turns out that kind of knowledge isn't what you wanted. It was an experiential knowledge of good and evil. We get knowledge, and it doesn't do you much good. T.S. Eliot put it this way in Choruses from the Rock. Endless invention, endless experiment brings knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Knowledge of speech, but not of silence. Knowledge of words and ignorance of the word. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Interesting image, isn't that? We can be hustling and bustling and lose stillness, lose life, and lose wisdom because we sacrificed knowledge with wisdom. I think it's the other way around. The fact is that we need to move from knowledge and move into wisdom and gain experience. Let me suggest two things that will make our minds different, and I've mentioned them already. People whose minds are saturated with the Scriptures, and secondly, are submissive to God's thoughts, will, I believe, have a wisdom that in eternity will prove far superior to all the secular wisdom of the world. True wisdom comes when you're saturated with the Word and you're submissive to what God is telling you in the Word. Not just to have it in your head, but also to desire it in your heart. If Solomon was so smart, why did he have 700 wives and 300 porcupines? The fact is that Solomon is one of those ironic figures, isn't he? He's one of those figures who starts well and ended poorly. In the middle of his life, he allowed these alliances. Well, the reason why he started was because they were political alliances at part, but he also just went off the deep end here. And he allowed his wives as well to cause him to succumb to idolatry, and thus he ended in foolishness. It's a great tragedy. This wisest of men became a fool in his older years, which is a real warning to us. Still, a man can have wisdom and still turn away from that in the middle of their course. And so he started well, and like several characters in Scripture, he didn't end well. So the thing we want to pray is that we finish well. I went to a funeral, and I'll close with this thought. Matt Prince was a mentor of mine. When I graduated from Dallas Seminary in 72, I went to join New Life in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Matt was the fellow who headed that up. He died last week, and I managed to go from Dayton on one of the days I was speaking and managed to get to a tail end of his funeral. And it was an interesting thing to see these things. And I realized, and looking at that situation with Matt, I only have so many years left. You know, here I'm 57, Matt was 73. And I realized, you know, another 10 years, I'm 67 years old. And I realized, you know, there's only so much time we have. 13 years, I'll be 70 years old. It's an amazing thought. And you must not presume that you'll have all the time in the world. Wisdom would tell us to walk in wisdom and to make the years count now, and you want to finish well. You don't want to end in foolishness and make some stupid decision, an immoral decision, or something that's brought about by the lust of the flesh or the lust of the eyes or the boastful pride of life. You want to finish well. Life is too short for us to make big, basic blunders where we have to go off onto another dead-end street. So it's just it's a word for us to realize how little time we have. Let's end well, and let us be men who saturate ourselves with the Scriptures and submit to what God teaches us.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.